Welcome to a new edition of Mercenary Musings Radio, a bi-weekly audio program featuring mining analyst and commodities expert, the mercenary geologist, Mickey Full. We are your most trusted source for in-depth analysis and commentary on commodities, mining, and the junior resource sector. And joining us from Albuquerque, New Mexico, is the mercenary geologist himself, Mickey Fulk. And you're just back, Mickey, from another road trip, a brief jaunt to a show in San Francisco. How was it?
Oh, it's always good. San Francisco is a wonderful place to visit. Wouldn't want to live there, but for wining and dining, it's hard to beat.
Okay, and it was a busy time at the trade show. Lots of speeches, lots of making connections and whatnot.
Yes, three public appearances and many interviews, which will be posted on the website over the next couple of weeks.
Okay, spreading the word. Sounds good, Mickey. Well, for this edition of the program, you decided to put fluorspar on the menu. Fill us in on the history, the characteristics of this mineral. Certainly, it's a mineral that's critical in a lot of applications in today's society.
Well, let's step back and talk about the element. It's fluorine, which is number 9 on the periodic table, 13th most abundant in the Earth's crust. It's the lightest halogen gas, which would include some things like chlorine and bromine and iodine, and then at the end of the periodic table, a really weird man-made radioactive element. It's a pale yellow gas, very reactive, pungent odor, odor, single isotope F-19. So it comes, now we'll segue a bit into what it actually is mined as, and that's fluorite. The mineral is fluorite. It's been used since around the 1530s as a flux for smelting metal ores. And that came from the famous Erzberger district, De Re Metallica, Agricola, who we've talked about before in Saxony and Eastern Germany and Western, what is now the Czech Republic, and it's a place I visited this summer. The element was discovered in about 1810, but it took 76 years to isolate it. Most of the production is through a rock product called fluorspar, and most of that is used to make hydrofluoric acid.
Okay, and what does it look like? You know, in the research that I've conducted, Mickey, I've seen it referred to as the most colorful mineral in the world.
Well, it can be. It's commonly can be yellow or green or blue, commonly purple. It can be colorless. Most mineral collectors will be familiar with the octahedras that are collectible, especially from the Cavern Rock District, Illinois, and it's this wonderful deep purple color. And a lot of that has to do with radiation damage from inclusions of uranium.
And where do we find this mineral today, Mickey? Where are the really big deposits? Who are the big producers?
Well, it's common in hydrothermal deposits all over the world, but it's mainly comes from China, Mexico, and some other smaller producers, which is a mishmash of countries such as Mongolia and Kenya and Russia.
Now, you mentioned that China is a major producer. We're not looking at a mirror story of what we have with rare earths, are we? Does China control the lion's share of this stuff?
About 60%, and Mexico would come in, I think, around 15%, and then you've got the rest of the world. So we are dependent on, or the world, let's say, not the U.S. particularly. U.S. gets most of its product from Mexico. But we are dependent on Chinese worldwide, and they are the biggest consumers. It's used for a variety of products. So you have acid-grade fluorspar, which is used to make, of course, hydrofluoric acid, which is then used mainly in the fluorocarbon and the chemical industries. You have metallurgical grade, which is a lower grade product that's used in steel smelting. You also have metallurgical grade, which is then converted to alumina silica fluoride, which is used, is essential for aluminum smelting. And Then you have, it's a significant amount of use in the ceramics business. This product has multiple uses all over the place, and it's it took me a while to research it because of all the varied uses. Mainly the hydrofluoric acid is used in the production of fluorocarbons, which are used as refrigerants. And this came about in the 1930s and 1940s with DuPont and General Motors. DuPont ended up with the patents, eventually bought out General Motors, but refrigerators became common in about 1949 or 1950, especially in North America, and that was the marketing of Freon to cool refrigerators. Before then, a lot of people still had ice boxes.
Yeah.
Another use, which we are all familiar with in the fluorocarbon industry, would be Teflon. And most of us, including myself, probably thought that Teflon was invented for the space program through when the U.S. sent people to the moon. Well, au contraire, it was actually discovered in 1938 by somewhat of a chemical mistake, although it did not really achieve widespread use until the 1960s. In World War II, the Manhattan Project demanded a lot of fluorine because that's it's the way that uranium-235 is enriched through the making of a gas called uranium hexafluoride, and that remains a very important use. A guy named Gore left DuPont in the 1970s and invented Gore-Tex, so I bet you didn't know your Gore-Tex jacket was made from a fluorocarbon product.
No
idea. This thing has lots of uses all over the board.
Okay, lots of uses all over the board. When we roll all of those uses into one, Mickey, any idea what the estimated annual global production is right now? And is that rate of production high enough to meet current demand? Any concerns on the supply front?
Well, about 5.6 million tons per year are mined, and that's been fairly steadily increasing. And a lot of that would have to do with increasing demand from the Asia-Pacific region, specifically China, the growth of their steel industry, and then we're also seeing more of the fluorocarbon industry move to Asia. The question really becomes, is does the world have enough or supply secure? And that's probably debatable at this point because the world's dependent on China. It's depleting reserves, it's desire to keep more and more product at for domestic purposes. So this led to a 50% increase in prices, say from the global economic crisis until early 2012. Looking at a more or less a 50% increase in price, but it's been flat since then.
Okay, and I think the price right now, what are we talking, $500 to $600 a ton in that range?
Well, that's for Chinese fluorspar delivered FOB to Houston, for instance, we're probably looking at plus or minus $600 a ton. It's very difficult to get current prices unless you're a subscriber to specific websites. And those things cost lots of money, so I don't have access. Although the USGS has commented about the decrease in prices in Q2 of 2012. Mexican fluorspar, which is where the U.S. gets most of its, from mines in Coahuila and San Luis Potosi, we would have to look at those as secure supplies, and they're probably about $100 lower.
Okay, so a bit of a difficulty in terms of getting a firm handle on the price. What about how difficult is it for investors to make money off this story? Are there opportunities?
In the junior resource sector,
yeah.
There's been a buzz and some promotion over, say, the last year or so about new opportunities in fluorspar. But unfortunately, we don't have the deposits to compete. I mean, you're looking at these giant deposits in Mexico that are very high grade. The U.S. does not have, or Canada, have those sorts of resources. The last our mines in the U.S. shut down in the early 1990s. Those would have been in Illinois and Kentucky and in what's known as the Cave and Rock District. Interestingly enough, where the collectible crystals come from. So we just don't have the deposits. There's been some promotion by a well-known Vancouver group recently, but tell you truth, Rob, I just don't buy it. I don't see the opportunities. There's one particular play in Newfoundland that was promoted last year as basically on the fast track to production, but with recent economics, and it looks like that is not going to be a viable project. It requires building of a deep water port on the St. Lawrence River, and so for investors, I just don't see the economic opportunity.
Okay, pretty good way to wrap it up, Mickey, with some very pointed advice for listeners. What do you want to talk about? We're going to do it all over again in 2 weeks. What's going to be on the menu 2 weeks from now? What are you thinking?
My mind is blank right now, Rob, so we will figure something out. We were working our way down the inert noble gases, and perhaps we'll go back to that.
You're just thinking of that meatloaf, which is baking in the oven in the background, aren't you?
Yeah, and the cold beer that goes along with it, Rob.
Okay. Good to chat with you, Mickey. We'll catch up with you in a couple of weeks. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Mickey Fulp, the Mercenary Geologist. You can find him on the web at mercenarygeologist.com. And you can always hear Mickey's latest opinion exclusively on mercenarygeologist.fm and kitco.com. I'm Robert Graham at Mercenary Musings Radio. Thanks for listening.